Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear a recent speech given by former CIA agent and anti-war activist Ray McGovern. He's speaking here about the current efforts by some in Congress to declassify the 28 redacted pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11 that took place in 2002. Members of Congress can read the 28 redacted pages, but can't talk about what they've read. Many who have taken the time to look at these pages have been really shocked at what they learned. There's a bill before Congress to get these 28 pages declassified. It's Bill H.R. 428. I want to encourage you all to call your congressperson and ask them to first look at the 28 redacted pages and then to sign on to the bill, if they haven't done so already. So let's listen to Ray McGovern's thoughts on 9/11 and the 28 redacted pages.
I want to start by simply saying that I was a young movement one time. I was a young person. And when I heard in my senior year of college, John Kennedy in his inaugural invite those of us who had something to offer, not to ask what the country could do for me, but for what I could do for the country. Like many other people my age, we were really inspired. And you know, there are still some of us left down here in Washington, or down there in Washington. Let it not be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot. Camelot had come. We were all inspired. I had just entered the Central Intelligence Agency after being an Army infantry and intelligence officer. I was just there 7 months before President Kennedy was killed. So the very poignant strains of the Mozart Requiem meant a lot for me today, and there are lots of other phrases in there that I may cite here if time permits. I remember who I was 51 years ago. Would you believe I was in the Pentagon Situation Room? We were young trainee officers for the CIA, and we were being given a tour of what goes on in the Pentagon Situation Room, and the word came. So it's not easy for me to forget, or to remember, actually, where I was. Had it all happened? Well, I recommend to you a book that was written by James Douglas. It's named JFK and the Unspeakable. David Swanson alludes to it today in an incredibly good blog piece that he has put up. I hope all of you know of David Swanson. The press, of course, helped then and is helping now to cover everything up. It wasn't quite as bad then, but it was palpable. We had Director William Colby saying publicly that we in the CIA control just about, 90% of the people in the press who are important. Well, you know, that boggles the mind. I found it hard to believe in those days. No longer. And so what I always make a point to say on any occasion like this is that even though I've seen a lot of change in Washington over the last 50 years, there's one that dwarfs all the other changes in significance, and that is that we no longer have a free media, and that could not be bigger. The fourth estate is dead. What's the good news? Is there a fifth estate? Sure as hell is, huh? Young people don't read the New York Times, the Washington Post. They get everything from the net, from the web. And so that's a great hope for the future, because young people are beginning to find out what's going on in this world. So that's a biggie. And as we see, not only with the JFK assassination, Douglas's book is by far the best. Have you seen it reviewed anywhere?
I wonder why that is, huh?
Okay, let me continue here. H.R. 428. We need to give that the greatest support because, as I'll try to demonstrate here, it is key to the unraveling of what people knew, how people reacted or did not react to the copious information that was available before 9/11. The Congressional Joint Inquiry, part of which were these 28 pages, was what we in the Bronx used to call a crock. It was set up with great opposition from virtually the whole establishment in Washington, including Porter Goss, head of the House Intelligence Committee, and, sad to say, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, a fellow who's sort of redeemed himself now. His name is Bob Graham. Cheney challenged House Speaker Daschle, saying, you set up a committee like this, we're not going to allow any administration people to testify.
Wow.
But then it became clear that if the administration didn't set up their own little controllable exercise here to investigate, someone else would. And that's when they picked Goss and Graham to ride herd on what happened. First thing you knew, the FBI is crawling all over their Senate and House offices. Can you believe it? You know, that's a different branch of government. Congress has its own investigative bodies. But Goss and Graham said, oh, yeah, there was a leak. Welcome, all you FBI agents. And they wanted to interrogate and subject to lie detector examinations congressmen and representatives. It was crazy. And that's the way it went. After it started out in February, they couldn't find an executive director for a couple of years. They worked till August, then they took a big vacation. And finally, in the fall, there was a report. Now, the report was quite amazing because Porter Goss, who was really the bête noire in all this, he was clearly doing what Cheney told him to do. He said, now, please understand, and this may sound familiar to you, we're not out to establish guilt or accountability. No. What we're trying to do is, quote, look for solutions, not scapegoats. Does that sound familiar? Right. I mean, Obama was a young boy then, I suppose, but he must have watched Fox News to find out that you're not supposed to look backward, you just look forward. I tried that on the NYPD when I was speeding the other day. It didn't work. I said, oh, let's just look forward. No, they said, you know what they said, right? Okay. So they bowed to the FBI demands that they could not interview the Saudis in San Diego. The FBI says, no, you can't. So, oh, okay, sorry, didn't mean to ask. One of the Saudi intelligence agents who worked in California as a quasi-diplomat was allowed to leave right after 9/11. Nobody questioned him. Of course, you know how many Saudis were put on those planes right after 9/11. George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA, he would not agree to be interviewed by the Congressional Joint Committee. And so they said, oh, gosh, that's too bad. So what happened? What was the report? Well, the report came out, I remember. I was in San Diego at the time. My youngest son was working there, and I couldn't believe it. What Eleanor Hill, who, to her credit, tried to do an honest job against insuperable odds, what she said was this. According to the White House and the Central Intelligence Agencies, and we fought about this well into the evening, Bush's knowledge of intelligence information relevant to this inquiry remains classified, even when the substance of the intelligence information has already been declassified. That was the case in the committee's final report, and we still don't know what was in those 29 pages or anything else that the joint inquiry found out about what Bush knew. What a great inquiry, huh? Well, it goes from bad to worse, guys. Next thing you know, we have a commission. Now, thanks to the pressure from the families, we had a commission, but it was, again, crock part two. Who was set up to do it? Well, well-heeled people like Governor Kaine from New Jersey, who knew nothing about Washington and its ways and admitted it. He said, well, I'll go down there one day a week and I'll learn. And he later complained that it took him 6 hours to get through security before he could go read anything, and then they wouldn't let him take any notes. And he complained about that. You know, it's really hard to be the head of this commission if they wanted you to do that kind of stuff. Lee Hamilton, he's the Democrat, quasi-Democrat that they trot out to be on these commissions. He screwed up on Iran-Contra royally, okay? And so for services performed, he gets to co-chair this. And If we needed further reason for proof, I mean, who was picked to be the initial chairman of the committee? Anybody remember? Henry Kissinger! The paradigm of honesty, huh? And what kind of clients did Henry Kissinger have a lot of? Saudi Arabia! Wow, okay. And John Brennan, who was interested in all this, and where was he the chief of station for the CIA? Saudi Arabia! Man, I tell you, we got a good Saudi connection here, or complex, or nexus of a connection. So, when Henry Kissinger was faced down, to the family's credit, and removed from consideration,
well, of course he did it by his own will, he couldn't do it.
Then we had Max Cleland, double amputee from Vietnam, knows a little about war that the others didn't. And all of a sudden, he's off the commission. So what do you end up with? You end up with 10 members of what my Irish grandmother used to call the upper crust. Now, you know what the upper crust is, do you not? Well, I'll tell you. It's a bunch of crumbs held together by a lot of dough. I remember writing at the time, and I couldn't get into the Post at the time, this one was in the Birmingham News. Not a bad rag there in Birmingham, Alabama. I said, why should we care about all this? Well, one need only to think of the still disputed findings of the commissions that investigated the assassinations of John Kennedy, Dr. King, to feel the corrosive effects on a body politic when cataclysmic events like this are shoddily investigated with their conclusions deservedly suspect. Now, what I'd like to do is turn to San Diego specifically and do what we used to call at the Harvard Business School, a kind of a case study. I mean, I won't even mention those two well-heeled Saudis that left very abruptly and left all their papers and their fancy cars behind, whose telephone records indicated that they were in copious contact with Mohammed Atta. I wouldn't even mention them. Or the flight school people in Phoenix, people learning how to fly a plane, or in Minnesota, learning how to fly a plane without bothering about how to land it or even take off. So I won't even mention, I'm just going to talk about San Diego, okay? Now, we have the 28 pages that are not available, and we have Bandar Bush, also known as Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador in Washington for about 87 years, I believe. But he was very close to the Bush family. And we had those people flying off, about 24 of whom were related in some way to the bin Laden family. We had two people who the CIA knew were terrorists and who the CIA knew were in San Diego, but who the CIA says they never told the FBI, or Richard Clark. Oh. Now, to his credit, and I think Richard Clark is one of the good guys here, I only wish that he didn't wait until he published his book to speak out. They all do that down in Washington. It's not as though he needs any more money. He should have come out right away, okay? And I think he's still susceptible to pressure because after all, he's one of the few, or maybe he's the only one who apologized, right? Well, Clark talked to two rather obscure community radio people in Denver in 2009 and said, George Tenet told me everything except the presence of these two terrorist suspects in San Diego. And so the interviewer said, well, how do you figure that? Was it inadvertence? And Clark said, no, it would have had to have been a positive, actual intervention by George Tenet, the director, to deprive me of that information. Well, how many others knew it? Clark says, 50 all told at CIA knew it, but they wouldn't tell the FBI. Ooh. Now, has Tenet ever been asked about that? Or the FBI? They need to be. They need to be under oath, okay? Another thing that occurs here is the fact that NSA, I want you to pause here because this is important. NSA had been monitoring Al-Qaeda very carefully in the years prior.
They had done a substantive report identifying the various nodes, the various places where people were, and they were intercepting the communications telephone from San Diego, from these two terrorists, back to Yemen, where the safe house was with the central for the communications. And guess what? People say, well, they only had the metadata. They had the content. How many conversations? The president says one. That's curious. The chief of the counterterrorism center says seven. So they had the content, they had the warning. Now, how do you explain that NSA didn't share that information, which is its job, with the FBI or the CIA or anybody in government? People who work at NSA, whom I know pretty well, tend to explain it by saying, well, knowledge is power, and once you give out that information, it's not yours anymore, and, I'll say, wow, I don't know. And the people, the FBI, or people, the CIA, say the same thing, you know, if we had told the FBI about those two terrorists in San Diego, then we wouldn't have been able to flip them. We wouldn't have been able to turn them, is the term we use in intelligence. We wouldn't be able to double them, okay? George Tenet had zero agents in Al-Qaeda. Here's two live bodies. He could be able to double them, but not if he told the FBI, because then they would come under FBI jurisdiction, San Diego being part of these United States. So there's all kinds of things that need to be sorted out here, and a lot of this is clearly covered up. What Richard Clark has said right on the record is that if FBI and CIA had done their jobs properly, quote, at least some of the hijackers could have been captured before the attacks of 9/11. Even Moussaoui, the fellow that I didn't want to mention in Minnesota, they captured him about 10, 15 days before 9/11, couldn't get the FBI headquarters to give them permission to look into his laptop. Now, how's that figure? The lawyer responsible for denying that permission, he got a major, major prize from the FBI the next year, equivalent to his already six-figure salary. Figure that one out. So, cover up? Of course there's a cover up. The question is, what's being covered up? I want to say one more thing, because I think it does relate to the 28 pages. And that thing is torture. Now, I've been writing and thinking a lot about torture, mostly because the CIA is redacting all the verbs, or alternatively, all the nouns out of the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture, so it's not really intelligible. And there's this little kabuki dance going on where the president says, John Brennan, would you please make sure that we don't reveal any sources or methods here? John Brennan redacts it. He gives it to the Senate, and the Senate, oh, we can't understand it now because you take it too much out. They give it back to the president, and the president says, oh, John, would you, hello. They don't want it out. Now, why do I raise it in this connection? Because that 9/11 Commission report depended almost exclusively on three terrorists who were waterboarded to a fare-thee-well. Now, can you get reliable information from torture techniques? Well, let me cite the head of Army Intelligence, who in 2006, when he heard that George Bush was going to pretend the opposite, he came out very courageously at a press conference in the Pentagon. His name was John Kimmins, and he said this, and I quote, no reliable intelligence has ever come from harsh interrogation techniques. History shows that. And the experience of the past 5 years, he's saying this in 2006, the experience of the last 5 years also demonstrates this, period, end quote. So you can't get good information from torture. So people say, well, why torture then, besides just showing that you can? Well, it's really pretty simple, folks. If you want bad information, torture works like a charm. If you want to prove that Al-Qaeda was working with Saddam Hussein, man, this fellow Al-Libi that they captured, he wouldn't tell our interrogators that. But when they sent them to the Egyptians, who are more accomplished at these techniques, gosh, He spilled the beans and said, oh yeah, I was a travel agent. I sent all manner of Al-Qaeda people up to be trained in explosives and weapons to Saddam Hussein. And President Bush announced that the next day as though it were true. It was a lie. And Ali B said that as soon as they mistakenly released him. He said, I just told him that I knew that what they wanted me to say. And so that's what I told him. Now, how does this relate here? Well, if what the interrogators, and there were CIA interrogators, were after was a certain story about what happened in 9/11, man, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded. Anybody remember how many times? 187. Man, this is a good group. Yeah. Abu Zubaydah, how many? Just 83, I think. And there was one other. So all I'm saying here is that even Senator Kerry from Nebraska, who was on the commission, said, when I learned about how they got this information that formed the basis for all our judgment, I said, oh gosh, this is really a little suspect. So let me finish up here. All I'm trying to say here is there are so many things that need to be put together. I hate to say connect the dots, but that's what we're trying to do. And I think those 28 pages are going to start the unraveling, just like a mummy. You know, if you take off that little first linen, you're going to unravel the whole thing. And so it's really, really important that we get those people under oath, that we get a separate investigation, which makes the only kind of sense that we have. And what we need to do that, I think, is a broad movement that cares not only about this kind of thing, and specifically this, but about torture and about eavesdropping and about all the indignities that have been inflicted upon us as a result of 9/11. Because I'll ask you to finish the sentence here. After 9/11, everything changed, right? Including this document, which happens to be the Constitution of the United States. I'll say one last thing because I think it's illustrative. We all have our own opportunities and our own call and our own chances to make a difference. Edward Snowden, whom I'm pleased to be able to call my friend now, having visited him again in September, I learned from a Forbes magazine article that one of his co-workers in Honolulu went to Forbes. Now, Forbes is not a left-wing rag by any chance, right? Okay. She went to Forbes and she said, look, you know, I really don't like this character assassination that's being applied to Ed Snowden. He was the best of the best. The reason he could do all those things is because he alone could do all these things. And besides that, every week or so, he'd whip out this Constitution that he held on his desk and he'd say to us, you know, there's a Fourth Amendment here, and I'm not sure what we're doing is really consonant. Does this bother you guys? And we would all say, Ed, you like it here in Honolulu? Well, yeah. You like your six figures? Yeah. Well, forget about it. Forget about it, Ed. So I asked Ed, I said, are you aware of that? He says, yeah, someone told me about that. I said, well, how do you feel about that? And his answer surprised me. And I recommend the lessons in it for your consideration. If it were I would have said, yeah, those people all knew we were committing crimes and didn't have the guts. But not Ed. He said to me, you know, I knew that someone had to do this. And as I looked around, she had a big mortgage. They had three kids. All of them had family and other responsibilities that I didn't have. And so I looked in the mirror and I said, well, somebody's got to do this, Ed. And I guess that would be you. Wow. There was no grudges. There was no criticism. He accepted that not everybody is in the place where they can make that kind of difference, but some of you are, or some of you will be, or you know people who are. And what we need to do is rise to the occasion. I'd like to finish simply by quoting one of the other mothers, Terry, which I had recorded here on an article I wrote at the time. Her name was Kathy Ashton. And she was in high dudgeon at the way the various investigations were going. She lost a 21-year-old son at the World Trade Center. She told Newsweek, we need to know the truth because my son cannot have died in vain. This can't happen to somebody else, but it will if we don't figure out what went wrong. Now, last thought comes from one of my favorite prophets, Rabbi Abraham Heschel, who is a terrific prophet during Vietnam and subsequent years. And he pointed out, Indifference to injustice, indifference to evil is worse, actually, than evil itself. Now, we're all not guilty, he said, but we all are responsible. And so let's shoulder that responsibility. My hat's off to the folks working on the 9/11 problem, Les Jameson and all the people from the early days of Not In Our Name and The World Can't Wait and all the other 9/11 folks. Let's get to it. Let's put our shoulders to the wheel, not be intimidated by the likes of Dick Cheney, and let's do it, because it really is up to us, those of us who have children and grandchildren, want a different country from the one that we have descended into. Thank you very much.
And again, that was a recent speech given by former CIA analyst Ray McGovern in New York City. And I just want to make a few comments related to the speech. First, Max Cleland resigned from the 9/11 Commission because he was not happy with the way it was being run. And while Mohammed Atta had connections with the Saudis, there was at least one other foreign intelligence agency following him around, and the other alleged hijackers also while they were in the U.S. And according to Atta's girlfriend, Atta was on Jack Abramoff's boat off the coast of Florida 2 weeks before 9/11. And while Ray McGovern believes that former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark is one of the good guys, while Kevin Ryan portrays him quite differently in his book, Another 19 Legitimate 9/11 Suspects. I would encourage you to check that out. And when Ray McGovern discusses the different agencies not communicating with each other about their knowledge of the alleged hijackers, he seems to be pushing the incompetence theory, that 9/11 happened because of incompetence and that lack of communication between the agencies. I think there's enough evidence to show that this was not the case at all, but perhaps part of the plan. And while I agree that we need to know and have a right to know what's in those 28 redacted pages of the 2002 Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11, I wonder if this new push in Congress isn't an attempt to focus blame solely on the Saudis and to let others off the hook. And I'm just going to read you now a little bit from an article posted on Press TV, which is called Saudis Acting Lapdog Role for U.S. in 9/11. And a former CIA contractor, Stephen Kelly, says the claim that ISIL came to power by the failure of the U.S. to investigate Saudi Arabia for the attacks of 9/11 is a massive case of denial, and the kingdom is acting the lapdog role for Washington. Kelly made the comments after former U.S. Senator Bob Graham said Washington's failure to investigate the role of Saudi Arabia in the 9/11 attacks emboldened Riyadh to engage in harmful actions, including supporting the ISIL terrorist group. Kelly said, "What we're seeing is a massive case of denial because most of the U.S. government structure was aware and behind and involved in the planning and carrying out of the actions on 9/11. He said, "We all know that it was a massive false flag operation. We also know that ISIL is a fabrication." Kelly said, however, that the Saudis were only playing the lapdog role, and solely blaming them for the September 11 attacks is an attempt by the U.S. government to deflect blame. So yes, let's go after our congressman to get those 28 redacted pages declassified so we know what's in them. But let's not wear blinders and only look at the Saudis and not hold our own government accountable along with the other foreign intelligence agencies that appear to have been involved. To learn more about the 28 redacted pages and the effort to get them declassified, you can go to 911truthoutreach.org or to 28pages.org or to hr428.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.